Welcome to Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Helgi Johansson, and I'm a consultant anaesthetist at Imperial and a Royal College Council member. Today, I'm joined by Dr. John McGuinness, a retired anaesthetist from Northern Ireland, here at our Anaesthesia Annual Conference in Belfast. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Helge. I'm honoured and privileged to be asked to be here.
So the main reason why we wanted to talk to you was a little bit about our collective experience of major incidents. And I know that you have extensive experience of one particular major incident. Luckily, they're all very rare, and we're very unlikely to have one in our lifetimes, but both of us have. And I think getting that collective experience out would be really quite interesting. First of all, just tell me, what was the major incident that you were involved with?
Well, the one we're referring to now is the OMA bomb explosion on the 15th of August, 1998. That was a bomb which exploded at the lower end of Market Street, the town in which the hospital I work, Tyrone County Hospital, is situated. That bomb exploded, killing a lot of people there and then, and injuring scores of people as well on that afternoon. It was exploded at 3:10 p.m. on a beautiful sunny Saturday afternoon. And that is the consequence of what happened that I would like to talk to you about.
So 3 p.m, this is going to be absolute maximum number of people out in Market Street, isn't it?
Yeah. But most of the people were just shoppers, mothers buying school uniforms and shoes for their children going back to school at the end of August. And some going to purchase clothes for a wedding party, such as a mother who was killed with her two babies that were unborn and her little daughter as well. So there are many people killed more or less instantaneously at that time, 3:10 p.m. on Saturday, the 15th of August. So it was seared in the minds of many people at the time. And in fact, it was the worst atrocity, single atrocity of the Northern Ireland Troubles in nearly 30 years and greatest loss of life at that one time.
I realise that we have quite a wide listenership to this podcast, and it may be just worth spending a minute giving a bit of background to why this bomb happened.
Yeah.
And I love the term the Troubles, which is such a wonderful bit of understatement. If you could give me just a 1 minute background of what led up to this and the Troubles as a whole.
Well, technically speaking, the Troubles had officially, in inverted commas, ended because the agreement had been signed by Mr. Blair and the various parties involved a month or two before, and elections were going to be held. But these were what called dissident Republicans who planted this bomb, which was in a car and parked at the bottom of the town. And this resulted in the many injuries. They were just protesting at the stopping of the violence by the Republican movement of the time. And it, like everything else, like all these things, was total waste, an utter disgrace and a shame on the people of Ireland, basically.
Where were you on that day?
That morning, I actually had gone to a church funeral for a patient who had, in fact, died on after surgery, a lovely man. And it was such a beautiful morning. I was with my son at the time. And the funeral oration by the priest in charge was so good. I actually went up and congratulated him. I thought it was a beautiful sermon you gave on this little man who died. And as we left the church, the funeral cortege walked up the street and people stopped to doff their hats as the funeral passed by them. And I just thought to myself, that's a wonderful thing that people just actually stop for a moment to pay homage to someone they never knew of. And that was the start of the day. And because it was Saturday morning, we, myself and my wife, we got up to Belfast to do a little shopping and to visit her mother. So we went to Belfast that morning, left our older children in the house where we lived in Oma, which is about a 5-10 minute drive from the hospital. So I was in Belfast when we got the news. And we got the news because my mother-in-law was on a little balcony where she lived, and she was waving to us as we approached. And she got us to ring our daughter at home, Claire. And Claire informed us of what had happened, that the bomb had exploded. And we were looking at the anaesthetist and the surgeons, and she got back at the hospital. So we immediately turned tail and went back home. I could just tell you, selfishly, like anyone else, I imagine, I asked her, was she all right, that she hadn't been injured All right. And our son, the younger son, who was about 12, that he had intended to go into town. But in fact, he was so busy making his paper mache Star Trek Enterprise that he didn't go into the town, although his friend was there. But he was uninjured too. So we thank God for that. And we quickly made it back to the hospital.
And how many of your colleagues made it back?
Well, it was a Saturday afternoon in the summer. So there are four consultant anaesthetists. Two were in Hollies further away, Francis and Cookie. And myself, I was off that afternoon. Ruben Lal Singh, who was my senior partner in the hospital, he was in town. So Ruben immediately went to the hospital when he was advised to go. He probably heard the bomb, I'm not sure. So he was early, the second anaesthetist, because that weekend we had Dr. Qureshi. Qureshi's a tremendous anaesthetist. He was doing the locum weekend. We had one weekend at five that was done by a locum senior anaesthetist that covered for us. So he was on that weekend. He was the first anaesthetist on duty at the hospital, at the Truth County Hospital A&E department. And he looked after particularly a little child that was carried in from a private car. But this little baby, about two, she was too ill. She died almost immediately. And Dr. Qureshi went on then with the other surgeons, Mr. V.V. Rai, who was actually an emergency surgeon, and Mr. Pinto, who was a consultant surgeon, came in as well, of course. And eventually they went up to the main theatres. I can probably give you a little layout of the hospital. There was the A&E department, which obviously rapidly overfilled. They used the outpatients building for additional people coming in. And the main theatre block is on the first floor, so two main theatres, which had been renovated to a great extent about 1994. So they're very high quality theatres. One actually had air laminar flow, very clean air, another one slightly smaller, four-bedded recovery unit and a two-bedded ICU. And above that, on the next floor, was a smaller unit for daycare surgery, which we use for smaller procedures. So that was the layout of the hospital. In addition, there was, of course, the hospital laboratory for biochemistry, bloods, and a blood bank, and the pharmacy department, and all the various wards and so forth. About, I think it's around 200 odd beds, including children's beds and surgical beds and medical beds. So that was the layout of the hospital.
So four theatres in total?
Two main theatres and one smaller theatre.
So three.
And the A&E theatre, which really was just the A&E, it wasn't a theatre.
And how many patients did you get coming in?
Overall, at the time, no one knew, they were just coming. But in my calculations thereafter, there were 227 patients admitted at that time, 55 male and 172 female patients of all age range, from very young to about 70 or thereabouts. That's a retrospective look at the time. In fact, a lot of the patients were brought up by private cars or by a police car, and the local bus, Ulster bus manager, he was able to get one of his buses to be filled with many injured patients that were quite badly hurt. And this bus was filled with patients and taken round right up to the hospital. The hospital was sited about 1 kilometre from the site of the bomb blast. So it wasn't a great distance, but still the bus took a lot of patients up at that time. And the bus was so badly damaged with blood staining that they had to remove the seats and so forth because it couldn't be used again for that purpose. So people kept coming. They arrived literally in their droves from the site. And I think overall, the number of patients from the bomb site was cleared quite quickly. So a lot of people all came together at once rather than, you know, too much in dribs and drabs. So it was a big influx and then lesser influx. But most of the people who died were actually killed at the site.
I can't quite imagine suddenly getting about 200 patients all in one go. How did that feel?
Well, as I said to you, I wasn't there at that particular moment because I arrived to do my first procedure with a consultant who came from another hospital, a surgeon, Mr. Rodney Payton. In fact, I qualified around the same time as him. So mainly I was in the confines of the main theatre block. So to be frank, I didn't deal with the outside. My colleague, Dr. Imnath Singh, the other consultant, he was senior to me, he did a lot of the work outside assessing patients, whereas I anaesthetised within the theatres. Of course, there's many other people involved, including the surgeons themselves, Mr. Pinto and his colleagues, and other people. And the physicians came in, Dr. Clive Russell, senior physician, and Peter Garrett, who's also chairman of the medical staff. So they did sterling work with their colleagues. And Miss Law, a consultant ENT surgeon, she was involved. Plus many other doctors came along that were volunteers I can mention them in a wee little while as well.
So you kind of developed a major incident response system kind of almost naturally. It sounds like you allocated the roles very quickly.
Yeah.
And you were in the operating theatres.
Yes.
Another anaesthetist was assessing and triaging, I suppose.
Yes.
And then there was presumably somebody else in overall charge.
Yeah. Mr. Pinto was a consultant surgeon in charge of surgery, if you like. Funny enough, he had drawn up a plan some time before for a major incident, which more or less went into action. Plus, a few months before, they had a Red Cross pretend a major incident with people dressed up with blood stains and fractures and so forth. So it had a little practice, coincidentally, a few months before that incident. So it went to plan. But in addition to this, of course, the nursing staff, I think you will be talking to some of the senior nurses that were there at the time, they had a tremendous role in organising it. And if I could just mention a couple of them, Joanne McCullough was a nurse at the time. She dealt with patients in the theatre and then transported a patient to the Royal Victoria Hospital, which is the main tertiary centre in Belfast. That patient went by helicopter after surgery in the OMA Hospital. Our intensive care unit, I mentioned, was two-bedded. But Sister Sarah Fisher, she was in charge of that with her team of nurses. She did tremendous work. Sadly, Sarah has since died in recent years. We greatly miss her. She did tremendous work. So the intensive care, maybe small, but it was used extensively in that we had a turnover in it and some patients had to be ventilated. I should add that the many volunteer people came, particularly from anaesthesia. We had a volunteer junior in training. Dr. Michaeline Kelly came in. She lives in Oma, so she came in and she took a couple of the badly burned patients up, ventilated to Belfast. We had Dr. Mike Lewis, who was a consultant surgeon, a consultant anaesthetist in the Royal Victoria Hospital. He came down and again took a badly burned patient back to Belfast. I'm not sure how all these people arrived, but they seemed to come and go from wherever. They must have got the word and they came and did their job. So without them, the work couldn't have proceeded as well as it did.
In my experience, I've been through several major incidents, including the Westminster attack and Grenfell. There's always a really great response from absolutely everyone.
Yes.
What I want to know is, how did it feel 12 to 24 hours later? Because these incidents take a long time to sort out and everyone comes in at the beginning and it's when the exhaustion starts to affect you later on that it really becomes difficult.
I agree, Helga. I'd just like to emphasize again, it isn't just like even anaesthetists or surgeons or nurses, but the tremendous backup. The pharmacy, let's take the pharmacy for instance. I acquired the information that there were 8 times the number of giving sets used in a normal weekly issue that were issued by the pharmacy. The amount of analgesic drugs were 2 to 2.5 times the normal amount for a weekly issue. And at that time, I'm probably showing my age, the gel of fusion was used as a plasma expander. And there were 13 times the use of a weekly usage of that. And of course, normal saline, there were 10 to 4 days normal daily use issued in the pharmacy. And as regards to the blood, the blood bank, I should say the pharmacist came in. The first one was on duty. There's always somebody on duty, but that rose to another 4 colleagues. The laboratory, 8 personnel came in from an additional person on duty for a blood bank and so forth, and 2 clerical officers. And there were 40 different patients that were grouped and cross-matched, grouped and screened. 140 units of blood were cross-matched for 14 patients, plus, of course, fresh frozen plasma and platelets. I should say the blood supply wasn't a problem because there was a taxi delivery service that came from the blood headquarters at the Belfast Hospital. We'd come down with blood and there was extensive use of blood.
I think that shows how much of a team effort this sort of thing is and how, yes, we can be on the front line, but if we haven't got the staff, support staff, the amazing blood bank and the pharmacy working overtime really to back us up, then we might as well not bother. We just can't do our job.
Well, this is it. I mean, any operation, whether it's an appendix or an operation on the toe or aortic aneurysm, it's a tremendous backup if you think about it. I would like to emphasize too that most of the people, they went around their jobs as they normally went around their jobs. I know in the operating theatre, we had actually 9 operating theatre nursing staff come in and 4 nursing auxiliaries. Usually there would have been 3 on call at the weekend. They did tremendous work. As I told you, my first patient was a young adolescent. He actually had a splenic injury and Mr. Payton operated on him. And just to give you a little example, a little anecdote, we did the procedure. he was able to salvage the spleen, so he didn't have to remove it. The patient was transfused and perfectly managed intraoperatively. But at the end of the operation, because the swab count was deficient in the swab, we got the x-ray department to come up with the mobile x-ray to take a check x-ray that the swab was not left behind. In fact, of course, it wasn't left behind or any instrument. But I just showed that the routine still applied. We didn't cut corners, say, oh, well, I'll try the swab later if there was one missing, but it wasn't. It was done correctly.
Absolutely. You just end up regretting later on if you don't do what you normally do and have the normal safety checks that you have every day.
I would suggest that people say, oh, how do you prepare for the sort of things that you were asking there? I say, by doing your job properly every day. I mean, myself and my colleagues, there were four consultants in anaesthetics. We didn't really have any junior staff because it's a smaller hospital and they weren't allowed junior staff. But we did work from dawn to dusk, literally at the front line every day. And that could have been maternity, infants, babies, children, adults, broken hips, aortic aneurysms, choking, ENT, bleeding tonsils, you name it. But what I would emphasize is that the patient in front of you is the one you deal with. And I give an example that the patient was being assessed, say, in this case, a room last thing outside. I would have them on the operating table in this properly equipped theater with piped oxygen, nitrous oxide, suction, etc., electricity. But every patient on the operating table was attached to their monitors, pulse, blood pressure, oxygen saturation, eventually end-tidal carbon dioxide, temperature, or put if there was a catheter placed as well. Every patient would be attached to the monitors before the anaesthetic proceeded, on the table. We didn't move them from the anaesthetic room, we just did it on the table. Pre-oxygenation, I would still advise anyone having surgery, make sure they get pre-oxygenated with 100% oxygen. Maybe that's not the technique now, but that's what I did. If they weren't fasting, you could assume that they had a full stomach anyway. Intravenous infusion and lying and running, blood grouped and cross-matching, as I've stated. And then what we used, what I particularly used, was the rapid sequent induction style of intubation. I'm not sure if all these terms are still in use now.
They are.
They are. Oh, that's good. I'm not totally out of touch.
Oh, no.
But what I'm trying to emphasize is that the routine that you developed, in my case, 10, 20 years, we didn't deviate from it. You kept the same routine. And then recovery, back to the recovery. The other very important thing is that we kept monitoring, obviously, constantly from the start of the operation, before it started, to the end of the operation or the anaesthetic. With the records, the pulse, the blood pressure, oxygen saturation, all tabulated on a hard copy. And I think my most important instrument that I had was a little clicker to attach the record to the anaesthetic sheet as a proof of the record of the procedure. Whether the oxygen went down or up, at least it's proof that you've done your best.
So did you sleep that night?
Yes. The major procedures that we did, there were about half a dozen very major procedures that required laparotomy. They were the ones that were done initially. So that went on from about 4 or 5 o'clock through to very late that night. The youngest person, not the youngest person, but the one of the latter persons that had to be operated on was a 9-year-old boy who had a very severe thoracic injury and shoulder injury. So we kept him and maintained him well. But because he was thoracic, there was a surgeon brought down by the police vehicle from Belfast Royal Victoria Chest and Heart Unit. And this surgeon came down with the nurse I mentioned earlier, Joanne McCullough, who had brought up a patient earlier. He came down and operated on that child. He's one of the last to be operated on that early evening. And that child did very well. He was continued to be ventilated and then eventually hand-ventilated to go up back from Tyrone County Hospital, where the surgeon had operated on, to the Children's Hospital in Belfast. The surgeon that operated him was Mr. Vladimir Anakin. Now, Vladimir was a very well-respected surgeon in thoracic unit in the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. And he was actually a Russian, and I remember had been, I think, the Spetsnaz, the Russian SAS, as it were. But he was a very nice man, and he did help to save that child's life. And as I said, the helicopter landed at the Children's Hospital in Belfast with the child late that morning or that night, about 1 or 2 in the morning. But the other helicopters arrived. There were 3 or 4 helicopter journeys to the Royal Victoria Hospital from Omagh, which had a helipad, which was maintained and illuminated and so forth. A well-maintained helipad that took patients from the Tyrone County Hospital to either The Athlone Galvin Hospital is about 36 miles away, or to the Royal Victoria Hospital, which is about 70 miles away. And the journeys were made accompanied by senior nursing staff and or anaesthetists, in particular Dr. Magdalene Kelly, whom I mentioned was in training at the time.
I'm slightly struck by quite how diverse your department was,
yes,
even then. Names from all over the world.
Yeah. To be frank, it was a very diverse, and I would say a very stable department, both in surgery, anaesthetics, nursing particularly. They mostly were local people, and the pharmacy and blood bank, as I told you. There was a great range of people from different parts of the world. Ruben came originally from Trinidad, but worked most of his life here. Dr. Nand, I think most of her life as well here. Frances Robinson, she was in leave, as I said, that week, weekend, but almost on her first or second weekend on call in 1988, a bomb went off about 10 miles from Oma under a coach, and this killed about 10 young soldiers at that time, and another number of 7 or 8 were injured and came to the Tyrone County Hospital that Saturday night. And Frances, one of the first her nights on call, had that confronted. Myself, obviously Frances and Rimnath Singh, we all helped to treat these patients. And one of them was also taken by a road ambulance to the Royal Victoria Hospital for further treatment of his head and injuries and so forth. So Frances took him up, ventilated. I should say that one of the training, if you like, that we had in our working time was because we were 70 miles from the tertiary units, that we had to ensure that patients who had to be transported were well cared for. So obviously intubated, ventilated, intravenous infusion, monitoring, kept warm with foil, etc., and put in an ambulance with the E-size cylinders, backup cylinders, and oxylug ventilators, portable ventilators, defibrillator if necessary. So all that went on over our years. Later on, they developed what they called the NICADS, and I can't remember what it stands for, but the NICADS team would come to take patients from the smaller hospitals to the bigger hospitals. But we were doing that, not quite day and daily, but we did it as and when required. It could have been 4 in the morning or Christmas Day or whatever, but that's what we did. So we were very well used to it. As I said, our practice for dealing with this sort of thing was doing our daily work as best we could. And I just don't mean the nurses, I mean particularly the nursing staff and the surgeons and all the other people we've mentioned.
And that brings me very nicely on to reflections of how things have changed between now and then. And essentially what you described then is almost a centralised trauma system, which is traditionally we didn't have in London. And when I started as a consultant in 2007, trauma cases in London were brought to the nearest hospital. And then if they were severe, then we would be trying to sell the patient to the neurosurgical unit or whatever else. And then it all changed in 2011, when suddenly we became 4 trauma centres for London, and St Mary's, my hospital, was one of them. And our case mix changed overnight from a fairly steady stream of kind of normal stuff to just trauma after trauma after trauma, which actually resulted in a 10% improvement in mortality for trauma in London, which I think is absolutely amazing. And this is about organization. And the reflection of that is the Westminster attack, for instance, where the assailant drove over Westminster Bridge, knocking over a load of tourists and then killing a policeman outside the Houses of Parliament. And what really struck me was how well organized that was in terms of command and control. And the cases got divvied out between the trauma centres, so no single trauma centre got overwhelmed with patients like you did, which just paralyses a hospital and makes it very difficult to operate. And so we divvied it out. We'd also rehearsed our major incident pathway earlier that month, I think, and had a very, very stable pathway where you start off in recess, you have a team in recess, you go to theatre, you do not go back to recess, and so recess never gets blocked up. And so that sort of thing, it sounds like it was already being designed by you guys just from experience.
Well, as I said to you, Helge, we had our experience because we we did it day and daily, if you like, at the front line. There was no question of, you know, if someone was sick, someone else just did it. One of your colleagues, it wasn't like, oh, well, you're going to pay me to do this or something. We just did it. You know, there's no question. And I should say, not just myself, but a lot of the people that worked in, say, this instance and others, they weren't looking money, and I doubt many of them got any extra money in inverted commas, but they just did it out of a sense of duty and vocation. I should emphasize, too, it wasn't just, as you say, the medical nursing staff. It was the people who did the catering, looked after the place, the domestic people who did the cleaning. The hospital, you asked me, what did we go home at night sort of thing. That evening, the hospital was so clean. It was amazing. Also, it was quiet. If you watch your American ERs and all, they're all screaming and shouting and so forth at each other. The silence of the place, and I'm sure you find that in your own work, that the silence was more all-pervading than noise or screaming or shouting. I think people quietly went around to work, sought assistance if they needed. And another group I should mention was the GPs came in. A lot of the GPs worked in the hospital over the years as junior doctors or occasionally in the hospital itself. And they came in, my own general practitioner now, Dr. Deehan, she came in, Dr. Hines, who did surgery himself, he came in, Dr. Pollock, Dr. Bradley, and many others who I probably omitted there. But a lot of people came in and gave their help as best they could. There was another chap, I mustn't mention, I think it was Seamus McAleer. He's an oncologist, and he was up in that small theatre, I told you, dealing with the small sort of cuts and bruises. I'm not sure exactly what he did, but he did a lot of work up in the smaller theatre, looking after people that were less severely injured at that time.
You mentioned the silence.
Yes.
And I have to say, I've been struck by the silence that you get when a good team is working well together. When everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing, it's not like ER people screaming out into thin air. It's just a quiet competence where you're working on a patient with the shared common goal. And I certainly found that as well in our major incident responses. The team knows each other, the team works well together, and you get really quite amazing results with very little fuss.
I was talking to my colleague who may be interviewing later today, the nurse Joanne McCullough, she used the term telepathic. Sometimes we knew each other, well, we knew each other so well in our work that we knew what they needed or what they wanted without even having to be asked. You know, someone would hand you, I say, a laryngoscope or whatever without being asked, or cricoid pressure without being asked, although you could well ask. But what I'm saying is that they did it automatically because they're so well experienced and so well trained in doing it. And our nursing staff actually cannulate a lot of people as a routine. So that, again, was a great assistance to looking after people. You asked me what happened at night. I actually went home late that night for a few hours rest, as did some of my colleagues, because we'd done the majority of the urgent cases and we came back early that morning to do the rest that had to be done. So it was another one or two more major cases and about another a dozen or so of the smaller cases that we needed procedures to be done with my colleagues and other anaesthetists that came as well. The distribution of patients of that hospital that night was that there were 34 inpatients in a Tyrone County hospital. 25 of them were adults and 9 children in Tyrone County Hospital on the first night of the bombing. 20 patients were in the Altnagelvin area hospital, which is the 30-odd, 6 miles away from us. And 18 patients were in the Royal Victoria Hospital. There was a 19th patient, that was the lady who I told you about, a 40-year-old lady, who she died after surgery in Tyrone County Hospital and after being transported by helicopter to the Royal Victoria Hospital. She sadly died from multiple injuries, particularly loss of blood, I would say. That was the distribution at that time. And then the distribution of patients decreased over the next number of days, so that fewer people came in or remained in hospital.
So about 9 months later,
yes,
on the 30th of April 1999, I was a medical SHO. I had very little experience in anaesthesia.
Right.
In fact, no experience in anaesthesia at that point, apart from as a medical student. And I heard a pop, kind of like a loud, almost like a champagne cork, when I was having a coffee in Old Compton Street in Soho, and the Admiral Duncan had just been blown up. So I was probably the first doctor on the scene as a fairly inexperienced medical SHO with absolutely no equipment on me at all, and experienced a kind of similar overwhelming feeling of helplessness as patient after patient was being dragged out of the pub. And here I was with no cannulas, no nothing. And it felt like an absolute forever until the first motorbike arrived, because the traffic had completely snarled up. The helicopter couldn't land there. The closest they could land was Trafalgar Square. And so it was a long time before any equipment arrived to the scene. Afterwards, one of my main feelings was anger. And I felt very uncomfortable about this because I'm not an angry person. And it surprised me that I felt so much anger towards this person who had done such an indiscriminate, disgusting act to innocent people. I wonder if you felt anything similar.
Well, I should say I've worked over the years, and nearly, unfortunately, all my first 20 years of working life was dealing with, not continuously, but intermittently, serious incidents. You will have heard of, maybe not yourself, but people around will have heard of, say, the Kingsmill Massacre or the McAravey Brothers killings. They happened around the Newry area. And I was anaesthetist, a very junior anaesthetist, as you said yourself, when they were brought to the hospital. There was one survivor, a Mr. Black, came in, and the consultant, Dr. Donnelly at the time, he helped to resuscitate this man who had something like 17 bullet wounds. He did very well, effectively. And there was another young boy called Anthony Reavy. He had been injured in multiple shooting killings, some of his brothers. We anaesthetized him at another occasion. And sadly, he died about 10, 12 days later, not directly from the bullet gunshot wound, but probably some other related illness. So that was an example of that time when I was working in Newry. In Belfast, for multiple instances, some things which I think you see yourself, you see things and you sort of forget about them. I mean, we're only like minor players, but when you see certain things that are there, you try to put them out of your mind. It's the natural thing to do. And then ordinary instances like fires, like house fires or a hayloft going on fire, you see a small child getting burnt terribly with that. I mean, that to me, in fact, it did me more trauma, mentally speaking, seeing those minor, one-off instances than this sort of major thing. But I agree, I would be totally ashamed to be associated with anybody that did something like that for whatever cause. I think violence on any scale is something to be deplored. We should never resort to it. We're supposed to be sentient human beings with consciences. And I don't think, I couldn't be the one to press a button or explode a nuclear bomb or whatever. I think this is an abomination, and it should be beyond us as human beings now. We're all mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and so forth. I think we should just get along. But it does make you ashamed. Even in my instance, for instance, I would have been on the Roman Catholic at the hospital, and I would be ashamed to think that some supposed Catholic had done this, but they weren't Catholics. They were just, evil people. And there are a lot of evil people around. And similarly on the other sides, evil people. The evil does pervade, and I think we do have to be realistic and realise that there are things like this that are happening, and we should not be tolerant of them.
So, John, when you were talking about the former experiences of yours, I think what struck me is that I was that same year, or within that same year, where we both had these experiences. You were in a different stage of your career by then. You'd had several formative experiences that had affected you, where you'd had to work through those feelings that I, as a, 28-year-old man, was working through at the time. And you mentioned all those previous cases. And I think it's a real reflection of how we deal with the terrible things that we have to see every day, and how they do affect us, but how, as a part of our resilience, really, we end up developing almost like a fast-track mechanism for working through those difficult feelings and those difficult thoughts. I felt the same when I was dealing with the Westminster attack. I dealt with it much quicker than some of my more junior colleagues who were going through the experience that I had as a 28-year-old at that time.
Yes, well, as you say, I was older in the sense that I was around 50 at that time, 20 or whatever plus years of work behind me. As you say, you see things over your working life in our particular type of job of anaesthesia and trauma and so forth that, well, you have to deal with them professionally, because you're not going to help somebody if you're going to scream and shout. So you do your best with coolness, professionalism and compassion. And I think that I could say that without a doubt, that most of my colleagues did their best. We didn't probably do everything correctly. I don't think anybody could, but we do our best. And I think the training which we received over my years in training from the Department of Anesthetics, the colleagues that taught me and so forth, it gets drilled into your psyche. So you instantly want to preserve the airway, ensure the neck is stable and so forth. And even yet, if someone collapsed, I actually carry a rather dirty Goodell airway, like they call them now, in my pocket. It may not be sterile, but I suppose it's holding on to the remnant of my anaesthetic time. And I would say that it might be of use at some stage to somebody. But I think despite all the CT scans and NMRs and so forth, your fingers are the things that work best with your brain and your eyes. That can do so much. Well, I'm never a surgeon as such, but I remember dealing with my elderly aunt, and I put my fingers on her tummy when she was quite ill, and I instantly recognised what was wrong, because she had rebound tenderness, which I don't know, maybe you have to have a CAT scan or something to prove it, but she had rebound tenderness, which told me she had a perforated bowel, and I was correct. And eventually she died a little while later, but I was able to diagnose it just with a touch of one hand, one moment. So I think that is something that we as professionals in medicine or in any job, that you retain what has been drummed into you, and you will never forget, hopefully, for the rest of your life. I like to say too that I had support, in the sense that without my wife Mary, who saw me off this morning, got me tuckered up and dressed, I wouldn't have survived probably. I can honestly tell you, I've had traumas in my life too, as has said she, and we're a team that, together. We've been together 50 years, we'll be 50 years in August, and I would like to say that anything I do is in tribute to Mary, because without her, we couldn't have been able to do it. And I want to thank her publicly here now. May I give you a little quote from one of the visitors that we came to our hospital? On the 16th of August, the day after the bombing, we were still treating patients in the theatres, actually. The new president of Ireland, that was then Mary McAleese, she arrived up at the hospital. And she wrote in our theatre visiting book, not many theatres probably have visiting books, but when we reopened our theatres in 1994, I got a little book, and any visitors came along, we asked them to sign it. So Mary McAleese wrote on this, the President of Ireland, "The day the redeemed side of humanity showed its generosity of heart in this holy place." Underneath that, two or three days later, we have the signature of Prince Charles, as he was then, Prince Wales, August the 18th, 1998. So they're both on the same page. And one other little quote, if I may. It's a short poem, a stanza. "Orange and green, it doesn't matter. United now, don't shatter our dreams. Scatter the seeds of peace over our land, so we can travel hand in hand across the bridge of hope." Now, these words were written by Sean McLaughlin, aged 12, from Macrana. And Sean was one of the victims that died at the scene of that explosion that day. So I think it was very prophetic words, and it's right that they should be on the library of the Oma Town. In fact, we had a copy, an illuminated copy, put on the wall of the hospital at Tyrone County Hospital in our intensive care unit. It was presented to us by our family.
That is brilliant. So this is a quote from Stephen Coyle, who's the little boy who was treated by you guys. And it's simple. "Thank you for saving my life." Dr. John McGuinness, thank you so much. It's been an absolute honour talking to you. And thank you for listening. We have more information and useful links in the episode description. For more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anesthesia On Air, and please review us and give us 5 stars whilst you're there. Thank you very much. My name is Helgi Johansson, and it's been a pleasure to record this podcast.
Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Bernard, one of the anaesthetist and training representatives on the RCOA Council, and the clinical content lead for Anaesthesia 2026, which is going to be beside the seaside at the Brighton Centre from the 12th to the 14th of May. If you enjoyed this special conference podcast episode and want to join us online or in person for some inspiring speakers, hands-on workshops, and world-class anaesthesia education, book your place at Anaesthesia 26. If you book before the 30th of December, you can get a 20% discount. Enter the code EARLY20, that's EARLY20, all capitals, no spaces, during the checkout. There'll be a booking link in the description. We can't wait to see you at Anaesthesia 2026.